Okay. My father was Jewish by bloodline, but he didn't practice any religion. He was part of a family of about 12 or 13, something like that. And his father died when he was very young during the Depression. And so he was raised during the Depression with about, I think, 9 boys, and the rest of them were girls, and by his mother, my grandmother, whom I knew and loved when I was young. And he would tell about how they would go out and collect potato peelings from garbage cans to make soup. And they were a bunch of fighters, a mean crowd. I can tell you about some of my uncles, one of them that committed suicide by blowing his brains out, another one that got shot in the belly with a shotgun, and different things that happened to them. One got blown up with dynamite. My daddy, when I was 4 years old, moved out into a rather rural area, and there was a little Southern Baptist church called Victory Baptist Church that just started up. And there was a preacher that came, a big fat fellow who could really shuck corn and wave his arms like a windmill. And so he came to the little country church there to preach a week's worth of meetings. And everyone that lived up and down that single highway on which we lived, is country road really, came out to the meeting because it was a source of entertainment. No one had TVs back then. This was back in 1949. That's kind of a long time ago for some of you. And this fellow began to preach, and my daddy and a couple of my uncles and 2 or 3 of my aunts of his sisters got born again that week. And when my daddy came back home, he decided that God was going to be the center of their life. My mother got saved too. And so he walked about 5 miles to the closest store and bought a Bible story book about that thick, an old brown one. If I saw it today in a junk store, I would recognize it. It had newsprint pages. And the drawings were maybe 2 inches high or 1.5 inches, little black line drawings, one for each Bible story. And he began to read those Bible stories to me every night. I can remember one morning getting up and seeing the dresser mirror cracked. And what happened was he was sitting there reading his Bible late at night with the kerosene lantern, which we use for light, and the heat from the kerosene lantern broke the mirror. And so that's the way I was raised. It was a one-room house, had a pot-bellied stove in the middle, kitchen in one end, we slept in the other. When it snowed, I literally had snow on top of the blanket where I was sleeping, where it blew in under the eaves. And so my daddy, every time the church door opened, we would go. Sometimes when it wasn't open, we would go. We went to every revival meeting, every prayer meeting, and I was raised that way out in the country until when I was 12 years old, I decided that I needed Christ in my life personally. And I trusted on the Lord Jesus and was born again. I can still take you back to where I was standing that moment. I can show you exactly where my feet were planted and give you the exact time. It was 7:14 one night. And Christ came into my life. At that point, I began to share the gospel with other people. Now, that's me. I looked a little better back then than I do now. Notice that hairdo? We got that from Elvis, I think. That's the pompadour is what they call that hairdo right there. Yeah, Brill Cream helped that thing out. Vitalis, V7. That kept that thing standing up there like that. And so whenever I got into my early teens, I started sharing the gospel with people just the best I could, best I knew how. When I got about 16 years old, we moved into another area where there was another Southern Baptist church that we attended. And this one was very evangelical, and it was during the hippie movement, back during the 60s, back about 61, 62, along in there. And there was a movement of God, and we would go out on the street and share the gospel. And we saw lots of people get saved. Young people would have what we called a Bible study on Friday nights. But we wouldn't go home till we all cried. I mean, it was where we all got together and we sang, and then we shared, just different ones of us would share and testify and preach, and we'd pray, and it'd last 3 or 4 hours, and we'd have us a prayer meeting, and one or two visitors would get saved, and then we'd all go out somewhere and get something to eat and get in about midnight, and we'd do that every Friday night. Saturday, we'd go out to witness somewhere, and then Sunday, we would go out and play football Sunday afternoon, and had a good Sunday night service, rejoicing in the Lord again, and that's the way our week went. And so when I got up about 16 years old, I was a shy fella. I really was really shy. I'll tell you how shy I was. When I was in the 10th grade, 10th grade, I believe, in English class, the teacher wanted me to read out loud a portion. They said I had a good voice. They wanted to hear me read something. And I had to stand up in front of the class to read it, and I cried. It just scared me to death. I was in the 10th grade. Nervous I was. But I had started sharing in the training union and speaking up as we would talk back and forth in these little Bible studies we were having on Friday night. And so we had a youth week. And they wanted me to take part in that. So they took the fellows that looked like prospective preachers, and they gave them the church services. But there was one opening they had for me, and that was the rescue mission needed someone to come down there and speak. So it was like 5:30 Sunday evening, right before they ate, that I was to go there. And I had never prepared a sermon, or I couldn't hardly read. And I was just scared to death. And I was sitting out in the front yard under a tree, trying to thumb through my Bible, see if I could find something. And my daddy came out and said, I guess he could see me struggling with it. He said, "What about the prodigal son?" Now, I'd heard that preached a lot of times. So I can do that. And so I went to that rescue mission, and I was so scared. I was just trembling. My knees were shaking. My mouth was dry. I couldn't hardly breathe. And so I got up and I looked out at all those hungry faces. I read the story and then I started telling it. And I can still remember it. I just got lost in the story. And I preached. I shook corn. I preached like a windmill. It just wasn't me, you know. It was an anointing. And I knew that's what I want to do the rest of my life. I knew it's what I had to do the rest of my life. I began to preach all the time, everywhere. By the time I was 18 years old, I was traveling, doing evangelism. On my 1 year, I remember my brother, he did the singing, and he went with me, and we went up in Missouri and Arkansas. It was 7 weeks before we got back home. We preached, I remember one time, 15 times in 1 week. And we were seeing hundreds of people be born again. In West Plains, Missouri, not too far from here, we had a meeting. Remember, I was just basically a grown kid is all. We had a meeting, and over 100 people professed faith in Christ that week. They shut the school down, and we went into the high school. People were praying and crying and seeking God in the high school. Now, I left there and wondered if anything ever became of that, and just recently, someone got a hold of us, an old man, and said, I was saved in that meeting you had in West Plains, Missouri, and I just want you to know that the gospel has been preached many times as a result of the meeting you did, because I've shared it all over the place. And others I knew that, in fact, did get born again during that week. So by that time, I was went to Bible college and continued to preach. And then one day they invited me to, I think a little earlier than that actually, when I was, before I got into college, they invited me to a place called Victory Valley. It was a place where they had some drunks that they ministered to in a farm, and they had young people come out and military, and I went out there to preach. There's a bunch of young people there. And I was always on the lookout for good-looking girls, you know, that love the Lord. But there was one scraggly one sitting out there that I just overlooked because she was flat. And she just didn't have any interest to me at all. It was this one right here. All right. I'll let her tell about her part of that.
Okay. Is my microphone turned on? Yes. Now it's turned on. My mom and dad got saved when I was about 7 or 8 years old. My daddy had been a very bad drunk, and they had a very bad marriage, but both of them just really got a hold of the Lord. My mom, she wanted us children to understand what it meant to be born again so bad. And she just didn't know how. She wasn't a teacher. She just didn't have any kind of gift to communicate. She wouldn't have ever been able to homeschool hardly back then. There was no such thing. But she took me to child evangelism classes. I want y'all to be familiar with Child Evangelism Fellowship. They just teach Bible stories with flannel graph. So she would take me to these classes. And then after, when I got 16, she would make me go, and she would set up classes during the week. She'd go visit homes and say, could we have a class? And then she'd pass out flyers where she invited the children to come. Then she took me to the teacher's training class, and then she'd pick me up at school, and she would take me to this class of children of 25 or 30 and say, now teach them the Bible. When I was 9, I trusted Christ as my Savior through this type of training, literature. I understood the gospel and believed. And so by the time I was 13, I was going to classes, learning how to use child evangelism. By the time I was 16, no, come think of it, they let me teach at 13. They let me start teaching at 13, and that's what I did all my youth. He was teaching child evangelism at the same time, too, but he was in Memphis, and he was a teenager by then. And, of course, he was traveling with his brother, like he said. That's where he's also an artist, and he was painting pictures, and he was going to do that for y'all, but it was too much involved, and we didn't do it. But anyway, they traveled together, and then we started... I forgot to tell them about how we fell in love and all that. That's y'all read that in the book.
That's the part I gave you an opening to tell.
Oh.
I was there, and there was a flat-chested kid.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, that was when Victory Valley was where they were opening up also for the military. And so I'd gone with a church group out there. I was only 13, and I hadn't even gone through puberty. I just wasn't, you know, I was just a little kid, and all these other kids were... They were my age, but they seemed so much older than me. And then this grown man with his brother stood up, and they sang and played, and then he preached the gospel. And it was a stormy day that day, and I was just sitting there listening to him preach. And all of a sudden, I really believe God spoke to me and told me, that's going to be your husband. And I went, oh, no, he's old.
Still am.
But it was such a strong impulse, and it wasn't like I was interested in boys at that time at all. I went home and I told my mama, I said, God told me I was going to marry this preacher that was there. He's kind of old, but that's what I think God told me. And my mom said, well, what was his name? And I told her it was Michael Pearl. And she said, well, let's write it down on the wall. Remember, my mom was a new believer too. She said, let's write it down on the wall and let's start praying for him. because we want him to be a righteous man if that's who you're going to marry. And so from that point on, we prayed together for him. We prayed that he would walk in righteousness, that God would give him power and glory. God needed me to be a helpmeet to him when I was just a child, and my mom trained me to be a helpmeet, to start serving him, even though he didn't know who I was or what I was or anything else. But just like we were both working in child evangelism and teaching children with flannel graph, we both started working with the military at that time. He was working in Memphis with a military,
Serviceman
Center. And my mom and dad, my daddy had been a military guy, was in the war. And so he felt such a compassion for the guys that would come. We lived in the largest inland naval base in the United States at the time, in Millington. And my daddy would send me out, and he'd say, go invite the boys into church, and then I'll take them home with me, and I'll feed them dinner. And so my daddy, would every week with what he made, would buy a great big 20-pound roast and all the food. My mom would make a big banana pudding. And the man, Al Sargent, that led the choir, he knows my mom and dad. He ate a lot of banana pudding and a lot of cake and a lot of roast beef at their house. He was a military boy. Anyway, so my mom and dad were preaching the gospel to these guys while Mike was preaching the gospel to these guys.
I got my own mic. Thank you. And when I was in high school, I'd gotten involved in child evangelism, and so I took a group of young people, a whole carload of them, into the black slum district of Memphis. And we would go and knock on a door and say, we would like to have a Bible class in your yard for a week. They would give us permission, and then we would go around and invite the kids and immediately have a flannel graph type Bible lesson like child evangelism taught us. I would drop off two kids who would get something started, drive a mile, drop off two more, drive another mile, drop off two more, and then I with a partner, and we would have a class. I'd go back and pick each one of them up, and we'd go somewhere else and have a second class. We did that all summer long, week after week. Yeah. No one was paying us. It was on our own dime, on our own dollar, and we did that, and many of those kids trusted Christ. I went back later and checked up on them. They received Bible correspondence courses. But we weren't just sitting around. We were both active ministering and reaching people for Christ. I got involved in the Youth for Christ. They started having me preach down there while I was still in high school. And from there, they invited me into the rescue mission there, and I began to preach two or three times a week in the rescue mission at night. And then they started a ministry with the military and invited me to do it, and I would spend the night with 40, 50 guys in a big old lumbering building in downtown Memphis. And I was the overseer of these guys, about the same age as they were, younger than some of them. And I would preach to them, sometimes preach all night long, minister, sit and talk with them. And many hundreds and hundreds of them came to know Christ. On the weekend, they would use buses to pick up the guys and take them to that place where I met her. But this was much later than the first time she saw me. I didn't actually meet her. And we would go out there to this ranch, this farm, and preach to them all weekend. And so that's the kind of thing we were doing. Well, when I got in college, they called down to college, her church did, and said, we need someone to fill in. Our pastor died. And so school said, would you like to go down to this Southside Baptist Church in Millington and speak? I said, sure. And so that's where I went.
Yeah, the reason they called is because my mom, we told my daddy, said, well, there's a preacher that is going to school at Mid-South Bible College, and we ought to call down there and check on him first. And so my mom was not only training me to be a helpmate, she was helping me become one by bringing him in our general area. And so he came to our church when I was about 16. By then, I had gone through puberty, thankfully. He still didn't pay a bit of attention to me because I was still too young and silly, and he was an adult man going to college and teaching and preaching and all that kind of stuff. But it was a time for him to get to watch me grow up and us to pray for him.
Well, after about 6 months of filling in for them on Sunday, they asked me to be the pastor. So I was, at that point, was about ready to graduate from college, or maybe I had, maybe it was the last year. And so I came on as the pastor. And immediately I saw, we were right next to the military base, and I'd been doing the military ministry, they had too, and I said, let's step this thing up.
Yeah.
Let's rent us a building and start and take, I already had a band going with my brother, and I said, let's get us a band going and invite these military guys in. So her daddy jumped right in, went down, got this old honky-tonk, cleaned the thing out, beer bottles, mud flowed through it, cleaned the thing out, patched the hole, fixed the plumbing, and got two school buses fixed up and started going to the base and hauling them down on Friday night. Man, we would pack that place out, 200, 250 guys plus 75 of our young people, and preach the gospel. And wow, what a great time that was.
We get letters now in the office of old men telling us, you know, I got saved there. But what you need to see is we were spending our youth, starting when we were just like not even teenagers yet, already trying to minister the best we could, starting teaching children, going on to other things. But that's how we spent our youth. Mike was our pastor, and I always was his right-hand man, even though he wasn't, never showed me any interest. Sometimes.
Well, what I noticed was when we needed a load of guys to preach to them, we'd send her and a couple of the other girls out in the bus to stand in the walkway where the guys passed and invite them. I remember one night, on Sunday night, I was preaching, and the bus hadn't arrived yet. We had to start. The military hadn't arrived yet. And the back door opens, and in comes Deb, and these guys are all crowded around her, and they marched down the front. We kept us front seats open for them. And it was these old theater seats that fold down, got the arms on them, you know, and kind of narrow. Had them packed in there. And so she starts making her way in. Well, these guys, some of them are climbing over seats and everything because she'd promised all of them that they could sit by her if they
could. It worked.
Some of these guys were about to ship off to Vietnam. You know how they are when they're about to ship off and die? Yeah. They all want to get married.
Yeah.
They all love the first girl they come to.
That's right.
Well, she had hundreds of proposals, you know.
Remember, I was in a military town where there were 20,000 young men coming in, what, every 8 weeks?
At one point, there was 40,000 young men.
They were sending new ones in every 8 weeks, and there was only a very small pocket of girls. So it was a great way to get the guys to come in to hear the gospel, and he preached to them.
So I was already preaching, and she gets in the middle, and the one guy won. He had just his neck was like this. His head was smaller than his neck. Big old guy. He sits down there beside her, and I'm preaching, and about two-thirds of the way through the sermon, I see him say something to her, and she digs in her purse, comes out with a piece of paper and a pencil, starts writing, and he climbs over everybody before she can get anything written, comes down front and said, I want to get saved. Come to find out he was a Navy SEAL that had kind of lost his mind over there in Vietnam. He was under psychiatric treatment here. He tried to flush one guy down the commode, threw another one out the second story window. Even the psychiatrist was scared of him. He got born again that night, went back the next morning and to see the psychiatrist. He had to see him every day, and he had something in his pocket. Psychiatrist said, are you taking up smoking? He said, no, sir, this is a book, a Bible. And he started telling about Jesus. 2 weeks later, they sent him back to Vietnam, and they said, you're cured.
Yeah.
And so he was gone. So that's the kind of thing that we saw all the time that was taking place almost daily there in our ministry.
And you remember, for those of you that read my book, or I think it was in Mike's book, it said, for the young man said, when you're looking for a wife, look to your right and look to your left, and the one that is ministering with you, the one that is a friend and a partner, that one's going to be your buddy and your friend in ministry. And that's where I was.
Deb was constantly witnessing these guys, winning them to Christ. And so as a young pastor, unmarried, I often had to go and visit in homes where the man might not be present. So always needed a female with me. So I started inviting her to go along with me when I needed to minister. And when I needed to get a bunch of young people together for a street preaching, I'd call her, say, get the kids together. She'd have them together. So she was my organizer. She was sort of my unofficial secretary. Now, during this time, I had girlfriends.
He's a bad boy.
I had always had some girlfriend around me, you know, that I just was thinking about, considering.
They were all so classy, and I was always such a hillbilly.
and so I would have her come along with me. Quite often, she would be sitting in the front seat, with my girlfriend sitting here,
right there,
and she's sitting right there. And I never thought about the fact that she might be the one. See, she was just this stringy-haired kid. And so we went on like that for about 3 years, I guess.
You remember that faith, hope, believing that he was preaching? Well, I had belief that I was going to get him in the end, and then I had faith, and then I had hope, and I had a whole lot of patience. Anyway, I got him in the end. Y'all have to read the love story in the book. Yeah, on our honeymoon, I kept calling him. Instead of Pastor Pearl, we called him Brother Pearl. I kept calling him Brother Pearl, and he would say, would you stop calling me brother?
Made it feel like what we were doing was scandalous. Three times a day, scandalous.
It was only 8 days from the time he finally said, hey, let's get married. My mom and dad were on vacation down in Florida. And they called and talked to one of the women in the church, and the lady said, your daughter's getting married next Sunday. You better come on back. They were just set up their campgrounds. And my mama said, which daughter? And they said, your younger one. They said, well, who's she marrying? The preacher. So they loaded up and came back home. And the theme of our wedding was to God be the glory. And God has definitely been the glory for our... Yeah, you see, he started right out shoving his finger down my throat, that bad boy.
You got established dominance on the front end.
He did. This is right after we got married with our new bathing suits. Are we cute? And then our babies started coming.
All right.
That's Gabriel. You can see we couldn't afford a high chair, so we used a box. And then Gabriel and Rebecca, now they're both pushing 40 and got a bunch of kids. We tried to get them to come, but both of them said, we got too many kids and too many cows and chickens. And there's Shoshana, you know, which
she was
one?
An ugly kid, wasn't she?
Oh, she's cute as a
See, girl. There's hope for your kids yet.
And all this time, Mike stopped being a pastor a year after we got married. And after that, he always made a living. He never took money for ministry. And this was one of our...
Yeah, what happened was, in studying the scriptures, I told some of you yesterday about studying what is salvation. And then the next year, studying what is sanctification. After that, I studied what is the church and the nature of the church. And I discovered that the structure we had and the way we were doing it was not biblical. And so I quit pastoring and started working for a living. Now, the thing that I thought would work best was selling paintings. So my wife and I bought a 25-foot travel trailer, hooked it to a 6-cylinder GMC pickup truck, and just headed out with $150. That's all we had. And the first night we were down in Mississippi ministering to a girl there that we'd been in contact with, and a tornado came up, and they all ran for the storm shelter, and we asked them, if it was about late February, if we could have their turnip greens. They said, yeah. So the old winter turnip greens, short and nubby and thick and bitter, and we went out and picked turnip greens and cooked them in that storm, that trailer just a-rocking, and that was our first meal on the road after leaving. And then we went up north and stayed in a state, close to a state park in Indiana. And there I sold paintings, first time I'd ever done it, never tried it before. I mean, I'd painted but never tried selling. And we just barely got by. I mean, sometimes it'd be $40 a week, just really barely got by. We headed out of there to some friends, invited us to California, to where some Christians were gathering. And we headed out of there toward California. And didn't have any money, had to stop in a small town, got a job for 2 days painting some signs. and running in a sawmill, made enough money to buy two pair of overalls, one for me, one for her, and get some more food and more gas, and got into Memphis, sold a couple more paintings, and then we headed out to California. Had a wreck on the way, patched the old truck up, kept going, lost three cylinders in the six cylinder, got there and had two cylinders pumping on 15 pounds, and that's all we had, running at 10 miles an hour. We got stuck out there with a stupid bunch of cultish people. It took us about 3 months to make enough money to get out of there. And we finally made enough money, overhauled my car engine, never done that before in my life, out in the parking lot. Tried cleaning the motor, the block, and had the heads off and the cylinders, getting them up and down so I could clean it out. And so I hit the, I've been using gasoline to clean with, and I hit the key to change the position of the cylinders. And when I did, it created an explosion, of course, with all the sparks and blew all the lifters all over the parking lot. It took me 2 days to find all the parts for that motor so I could go back to rebuilding it.
We didn't have it all together at all.
We got that thing back together and headed home with just barely enough money for gas. We figured not enough to eat on. And so we stopped off at Oklahoma in a roadside park. Do you remember that? That's where Rebecca started.
Yeah, we finally started having babies. Yeah. I was beginning to wonder if we'd ever have any children, but we finally started having babies. And then once they started coming, we started having babies real regular. Then we both are professional.
We started painting and got a kiosk in a mall. And I was making $50,000 a year in a four-week period selling paintings. And that's the way we made a living the greater part of our life. And that's where we accumulated our poverty. I mean, our... we were able to build a house, buy some property, and get tools and stuff like that, which when we sold that, we had enough money to go out and buy 100 acres at Cane Creek and build a house and then live poor again.
Well, while during all this time when he was painting signs and painting pictures and we were raising kids, we also decided to homeschool. And 35 years ago, it was just like, you're doing what? You know, it wasn't long before we had the truant officers come into our house. We had social workers. We were summons to court. We were just like, you know, it was just like living in a powder keg. So it was very distractive. Mike was going on the streets like three nights a week preaching and teaching, and then we had all the children, and then we were both of us painting and trying to do things to make a living. But right in the middle of it all, we still had a vision. We had a vision to reach the gospel, and every evening we'd get in the bathtub and we would try to figure out how we could reach the world for Christ. And I know it sounds weird, but I got in my mind that if I filled out enough of these, whatever you call these things.
Sweepstakes things, yeah. Back to the Reader's Digest sweepstakes.
That we could win $1 million, and God could help us win that $1 million. And if we had $1 million, we had both heard that somebody had put a lot of chick tracks in the prisons in Mexico, and that there was a glorious bunch of people just getting saved. It was just a revival. Oh, we were so fired up. We said, if we could get $1 million, I'd sit down with a piece of paper while the kids were doing school, and I would figure out how many chick tracks I could buy and which ones would give the gospel and how many prisons there was in America. And then I would look at the chick tracks and I'd go, they don't quite give the gospel. And then he wrote a track, would put the... Jesus on the front and put the sins. I thought this would work and we could get it for 2 pennies each. Now we could really get the gospel. And I just, every day I was filling these things out. I mean, it was just like, and every evening we would sit in the bathtub and we would talk. Okay, this is how many we would need. Okay, we don't need 1 million. We need to win this $3 million lottery or sweepstakes because if we could reach. And when I was putting those things in the mailbox, I would pray, oh, Lord, you know we need money to win the world because how can we ever get enough, be able to reach people if we can't print the gospel for them? This is a chick tract that I finally decided was the one. And of course, I tell you that we were fighting. We ended up in the newspaper. Oh, it was just terrible, some things that happened to us. We ended up, somebody told us when we got in trouble with the court system that if we contacted the newspaper and the TV, that they would find us interesting, like Duck Dynasty people, and they would put us in the newspaper. It worked. They came out, met our family, saw where Mike doing all the stuff he was doing, and so because we became sort of well-known, infamous, I guess is the word. Is that the word? It helped keep the heat off of us for a little while, but we even made trips down in Belize doing missionary work. Mike got a snake.
Yeah, well, I caught that snake on the riverbank, and when I came back to the camp where we were, that's a boa constrictor, the first thing Deb said when she saw it was, "Can we eat it?"
He kept me skinny all my married life.
Well, we were there 3 months and really didn't have much protein, so yes, we ate it. It was the longest barbecue we've ever had. Fed 20 people.
The time finally came in 1986 where the ministry that we'd been involved in was the military, and the war was over. The military base had died down, and we were right in the middle of trying to raise 5 children. We needed to get out of the city. We needed a fresh start as far as trying to focus on the family. We had been involved in so much ministry. The children had seen so many people get saved. They grew up watching broken people come to know the Lord. And
yeah. You know, Al's the one who carried the stones to the top of that house for me to lay the chimney on that thing. Poor sucker. I mean, he worked himself to death for me. And we worked on that house for a couple of years building it. Now, what we hadn't mentioned was, like, during this time, for the previous 12 years, we had rented a building and had a Christian servicemen center of our own right next to the base. And there we saw thousands of guys come to know Christ, too. So though I was working for a living by doing the art that I did, I was tied up for about 2 or 3 months of the year in preparation and then the being in the mall itself. But after that, I was free to minister. So we went to Belize and worked with a missionary for 2 months during January and February. 1 year, we had the servicemen center open all the time, every night of the week. And so we would win hundreds of those guys to the Christ. We even won the guy who ran the Long Branch Saloon across the street got saved at that servicemen center. A lot of drunks that lived locally got saved. Some of them, one of those guys right now, dopehead drunk kid that lives in the community where we are, goes to church where we go, and he was just a punk off the street, about 18 years old. He and his wife, at the time they were shacked up but not married, but after they got saved, they got married, and so we've had contact with these people and know that the gospel really did change those lives. Now that's when we were, that's about the, pretty close to the age we were when we decided to move to the country. We were doing fairly well there.
We were affluent, sort of. We could go to the, you know, McDonald's if we wanted to, or anywhere we wanted to go eat, and I had a washing machine and dryer. I had, you know, I mean, it was nice.
That's life. That was a big house with lots of stonework and cedar, and inside a special special floor that I made, and it was featured as an unusual piece of architecture. And so Deb came home one day from being with her parents up where they used to live years ago, and she'd visited a community, and she started describing it, and I said, "Let's go."
What?
We got in the car.
I said, "What?"
We got in the car, drove up there, and for about 6 months, we bought maps from Corps of Engineers, studied the topographical area, and we looked until I found the piece of land I wanted, and I found who owned it and made them an offer on it, and it took us about 6 months before we were able to buy. We sold our house for enough to pay the land off clear and have enough money left over to build tools that we would need to cut the trees down. I built a sawmill. And we had our chainsaws, our pickup trucks, and everything all ready to go, trailers. So by the time we got on the land, we were well set. But once the house was built, within 4 months, we had a house built, all out of lumber we sawed up. We were down to just maybe $500.
story.
And so we lived that entire winter and into the next spring until our garden came in off about $500. There was not much work to do. I got a job for $5 an hour laying stone one time. Got another job building a little barn. So from time to time, we'd get little jobs here and there that would help us out. But during that time, Tim and Rachel, who are here now,
they went home this morning.
They went home. They were singing up here on the stage, the little bit older man and the not-so-old, fine-looking young wife of his. They were Amish. And we began to minister to the people around us, and they started getting saved, and a church was formed within a very short time. And so that's how the ministry at Cane Creek began. We didn't intend to start a church. We just intended to win people to Christ. But it resulted in people wanting to meet together, and so out of it came a little church. That's the boys with one of the tools I made, a sanding tool.
And that's when we started Be Hillbillies. We changed our style. And that's where we lived when we moved there. Boy, it was a shock to my system.
One little one-room shack we lived in for 6 months while building the house. 4 months.
That's our five kids. That's once we got into the big house. It's still, we built it for $3,000, so you know it's not much. We started working with handicapped children, foster children, for 10 years, and we loved it, and we learned so much and grew as a family. We showed you that Nathan when he was about 16. He thought he was a dude. You also saw the videos with the floods. That's all our front property. It flooded like that every year for years, and our little girls are standing out in it. That's our driveway right there. There's our neighbors. They grow sorghum every year, and that's when they cut it, they dry it, they haul it off and stack it, cut the ends off, and then they cook it down. And that's our bridge, the men of the community.
Yeah, not long after we moved there, the same year, I think the old bridge was falling down, so we just got together and built our own.
That's how I washed clothes. It was quite an adventure for me. All you girls that are married to visionary men, I tell you what, I've had my visionary too.
And you see that little building in the back right there? That's a one-seater toilet. That's what you have, wintertime or summer.
And this is what we ate. I still have this garden. We put up, you know, like 1,000 jars every year canning because we didn't have a freezer. Now I try to freeze a lot because it holds more nutrients. But then came the day when our daughter was about, Rebecca, the oldest one, was about 16, and a friend sent us a video called Etal. And that video told about an Amish family that had gone to Papua New Guinea, and they had shared the gospel with a tribe called the Moke people. And after she watched the video, Mike at the time was teaching on Ecclesiastes. And so everybody in the church, which was only like 30 or 40 people, they said, you know, why are we doing the things we do? You know, every generation we just plant crops, we raise kids. There's got to be something eternal. And Rebecca decided, she came to us and said, I want to go to Papua New Guinea. I want to meet this family. I want to know about missions. And so there we did. We sold our cow because we didn't have any money. There's Rebecca. She learned to play the harmonica, what do you call that thing? Mike rebuilt it.
That's a ukulele. That's a chair I made. She's sitting in.
Yeah, and that's the quilt. Anyway, she takes off to Papua New Guinea, and she comes back before she ever gets home. Before she ever got home, I got a phone call from a man, and he said, I've been in a missions program with your daughter for the last several weeks. And he said, I want you to know I've been doing this for years and years and years. He said, I have never met a teenager so focused on winning the world for Christ. He said, so I want you to know, what if she wants to go into missions, I will support her starting the day she enters college so she can learn linguistics. And when I was holding the telephone, I was just crying because I knew that our life would never be the same. I was proud of her. I was glad. But in a way, I was going, you know, I felt like she was already gone because God had obviously called her. And so there's Papua New Guinea. I didn't even know where Papua New Guinea was. I wouldn't have had a clue. I thought, you know, it was New Guinea was the same place over in Africa. I didn't even know there's two different places. Anyway, she went. Nathan went with her. And then Gabriel, our other son, he went with her for a while. And they ended up on the top of a mountain. I mean, it was treacherous where they had to fly to one side to the other, catch a teeny weeny little plane, fly to a base of a mountain where there's a lot of wreckage of other planes, and then climb for like 8 hours up a mountain into a place where the people had never even seen a white person, much less a tall one. And Gabriel and Nathan, especially Gabriel, was seriously tall, and these were little pygmy people. And they just loved Rebecca, and they took her in for their sister. And Rebecca, by then, had graduated from college, and she was a linguist. And after being there for a few months, she wrote and she told us, you know, these people, they're dying off, and the young people all know the trade language, which is Pidgin. And she said, they don't even have a Bible in the language in Pidgin. There's a Catholic Bible, but it's put together with bad glue. And so nobody, and so up here in this wet area, the Bibles fall apart. Nobody has a Bible at all. Nobody does. And she said, Daddy, could you figure out a way how the people could have a Pidgin Bible? So that's when we contacted a missionary who's not a good speaker, but he is a very good organizer.
And what he did was found a number of former missionaries, or missionaries at that time, who had made translations into the Pidgin language, but didn't have the funds, the money, to actually produce it. So he got a number of those, over 10, I don't remember the exact number, and worked them all together and got some people proofing them and came up with a version and then had it printed with a cover that was
waterproof,
it wouldn't be damaged, and pages that would endure in glue. And so we had a large number of those printed and distributed them out to the people in there, and Rebecca's village got them. What'd she say about that?
Rebecca said that everywhere she went, when she came out of the mountain, she said the men all had Bibles underneath their arms and carrying them around. They were just so amazed that someone cared about them enough to provide 20,000 Bibles. So that was our first time to get into the possibility of getting Bibles translated into languages where they didn't have Bibles. And then after about 6 or 8 months, Rebecca called back. She couldn't use a telephone, but she could patch in with radio. And she called back and said, Daddy, you know, most of these people can't read. She said they just barely read like a first or second grader, and they don't know who Noah is. They don't know anything about creation. They get everything mixed up with their belief on spirit worlds and all that kind of stuff. She said what they need is a picture book that'll tell them and show them, so the little bit of words they can figure out, they can look at the pictures and figure out God created the heaven and earth. They need to know who God is. Until they know who God is, they can't really believe on Jesus. They just are believing my words, but they need to believe. They need to see and understand. And she said, that's what the people need. And
so what we did, we contacted different people who had picture Bibles, Bible story books, and asked them if we could use them. Many of them were in the New International Version. They wouldn't let us reprint them, wouldn't let us put them in a proper text. They wouldn't let us rewrite them to take errors out. They wouldn't even let us buy them as they were without giving them somewhere around $6 or $8 to $10 a piece. And so we just really couldn't find a way to adapt to something someone already had. So I decided that we would make our own. And to spite all of those entrepreneurs out there making money off of Bible story books and what God's doing, we decided to make it free to all missionaries everywhere that want it, and to use our resources to help translate it and even publish it so they could distribute it. And so we found a artist, a retired, not retired, but he quit because he was a Christian. He was a Marvel comic book artist, Danny Bulinati. And so we contracted him, and for 7 years.
7 years.
I wrote, I'd draw the little sketches, send them to him. He would do the inking. He sent it back to us, and then Clint Searley, who's here, where's he at? Sitting right over there on the stool with his hand up. He was the graphic artist who did all of the colorization of the book. And that again took, I don't know what, Clint, a year or two? He doesn't know. Five, it took a long time.
It's a big project.
And so then we had to put the text in, the bubbles, and all of that. And it was just a project far bigger than anyone could imagine. And then came the time to try to put it into other languages. And we found that's a headache. You get someone to translate it, and then they give it to you, and you're supposed to put it in the bubbles. What goes in what bubble? I mean, you can have the devil saying something Jesus said and vice versa. And so we had to employ different people from all over the world. We found a man already working in the ministry in Thailand who was a publisher, who knew a lot of different missionaries. And we started giving him $5,000 a month and still give him $5,000 a month, every month, from a ministry. And in addition to that, from time to time, we give $10,000, $5,000, $10,000, or $15,000, or $20,000 for publishing something that's translated. And so he began to contact different people in order to get the translations done, and he set up right there, using some nationals, paying them very little. He set up a translation house where they put the languages into the bubbles and where they know both English, or in some cases they may know Thailand, may know Thai, and they're working in the Laotian language, so they'll know Thai and Laotian but not know English, so let's start with the Thai. And so we've seen it proliferate now to, they're already published and distributed over 42 languages.
Yeah.
And many more languages are in the process of being worked on. And while we're here, a family came up whose parents and they have worked with a million Aztecs speaking the Aztec language in northern Mexico. And so they've contacted Mel and our people, and we're already in the processes of seeing to it that that Bible is put in the Aztec language, Bible storybook is put in the Aztec language as quickly as possible.
Yeah, from this point on, not starting with Papua New Guinea and not starting with this language, but starting going east, it's gone all around the whole world. And just about 2 months ago, I was sitting in the office and I was talking to our workers and saying, now, what language and how are we doing, how are we doing? And I realized we miss Papua New Guinea. And so now we are actively working with a translator to put it into the language in Papua New Guinea, and finally the people there who have been waiting now for like 20 years, because Rebecca now is 40 years old, they are going to have a picture Bible to teach them who God is and what he did for them. Now that the book is in print and we've got it on the internet, All 42 languages are on the internet, so all during the day, we see where people are clicking and reading. The Arabic was the very first one we put up, and people are clicking and reading and going through that Good and Evil book. And then God has sent us some amazing, wonderful co-workers to where sometimes me and Mike just lay in the bed and almost weep with thanksgiving that God just raised them up. And two of them are Jarretts. One of them's Jared and one of them's Jarrett. But both of those men have such a vision for reaching the world for Christ. And so now we're working on the DVD.
Yeah, the Jarrett, the one who does the sound system back here, the guy with the kind of ugly legs that runs up and down every once in a while. He is had the idea of putting it into animation, like they use in East a whole lot. And so we worked on that a long time. He got a bunch of people together to act the voices. He got some professionals to do the scoring on it is original, all the music, background, and sound effects. So what we're working on a program now, we've hired it out. And I think it's somewhere around $40,000 we're putting into that, which is going to facilitate the translation of it. The way it works is when, like right now, even right now, when there's some translation going on in Laos, and we got a person over there working with them, okay? She does a day's work on the computer recording the voices of the people there, and Jarrett receives it back here instantly. So we're working on a program to help transfer the voices and all that material to the right location. I don't understand how it works, but it sort of automates the process to where it'll make it easier to repeat this in many, many, many more languages.
Have you noticed that the dots that are connecting here, all those years ago, you know, it wasn't for God, it wasn't many years ago at all, it was like 20 years ago, I was praying, saying, God, we want to get the gospel. We just want to get the gospel into the prison so bad. Could you please give us $1 million so we can buy these chick tracks and get them into... And now, Mike said last night when we were laying down, he said, you know, God has so multiplied our 2 fishes and 5 loaves. We just wanted to... We had such a small vision, but he wants us to have a big vision to win the world. Here's the translators for the Pidgin Bible, and there's the Pidgin people. They're beautiful people. And this is where we've translated. Some of our translations have to go in black and white rather than color. Here's the gospel going out from New Guinea and going around. The reason I put this in here is because a brother in Christ was over in, I think he was in Thailand or Burma, and he said that he was walking down the road. There's the Hmong people. TJ said they're about the smartest people on the earth. There was the very first odd language we had. And there's the Thai people. I wanted you to see how the people live, but this man was telling me, the brother in Christ that was over in whatever country he was in, Burma, he said he didn't realize how important it was for the people to hear the whole story of God, all the way from creation, all the way through. He said until he was over there, and he said he was coming out of a restaurant and walking down the road, he saw this old lady carrying groceries. And he said she was just minding her own business, walking down the road. And he said a motorcycle, or a moped, they call them, accidentally hit one of her thing, swung it around, knocked her down. She was laying wounded in the streets with everybody driving around her and the groceries all laying everywhere. And he said he just stood transfixed watching for about a minute, everybody just going around her and nobody ever even checking on her. And he said he finally just took off running as hard as he could, and he went to the street and he helped her up and he gathered all her groceries up, and he can speak the language somewhat, and he said to her, "What's wrong with these people? Why didn't they help you?" And she basically said to him, "What's wrong with you that you are helping me?" And he said he realized over there they're all Buddhist and they're reincarnation. Anyway, and he said they feel like if she suffers in this world, then she'll come out better in the next world if she dies. And so he said to give these people the gospel, they have to understand who God is. They can't just be given the gospel. It takes the whole story for it to all make sense. They have to learn to be nice human beings. They have to learn Proverbs. They have to learn so many things of who and what God is. And there's our animation. There's men working on translation and doing the... And there's our hope and dream of reaching the world for Christ.
Yeah, it's a tremendous blessing. You know, we were wanting $1 million and then $3 million that we could use in the ministry. For the last decade and more, we've spent over $1 million every year in ministry, on missions, and we continue to. And it's been able to take place because of the gifts that people have given to the ministry. You know, when you look at our office, about two or three of the people is really all we need to handle the book sales and stuff going on there. And if we had one really sharp person that was hard working, one person could do it all. Pack up about 50, 60, 70 boxes a day and keep the books and all that sort of thing. Take somebody of high energy, but one person working 8 or 10 hours a day could do it. But we have usually somewhere around 12 to 15 people working in the office. See, what are all the rest of them doing? They're answering your letters. They're reading your emails. They are coordinating things around the world that are taking place.
Yeah, Mel says on any given day, he has to handle business or ministry on almost every continent of the world. That's God, amazing.
Yeah, God put Mel into our life. We hired him and to look over the books and tell us, make sure we're doing everything legal. Being a man of high caliber professionally, and we'd heard about him, and so we paid him, I think, $6,000 for one day to come out and view the whole ministry. I think it was 2 days. And to look at all our books and tell us what we're doing right and wrong, and write up a recommendation on how we could better stay legal and make everything work right. So he worked up this thing and told us all about it, and I said to him, "Won't you come to work for me?" And he had already made a commitment to God to spend some of his latter years working in ministry, and he was actually working with a ministry at the time, and pretty soon he said, "Yeah, I'll come." And so he came, and he's the one who opened up the ministry, so our books are sold commercially on Amazon and in the big bookstores and places like that. He's also the one who went to the trade shows and got a person who, I forgot what you call them, but they take care of our contracts with foreign printers. Like, you know what, the other day, Chinese printer contacted us and said, "We'd like to print Good and Evil in Chinese for distribution in China." So we signed. We sign a contract granting them permission, and they pay us for it.
They did the same thing with Created. They said it's real, real good seller in China, and they pay us for it. And people are reading the gospel, and
so
it's
we
amazing.
Yeah, you know, we had been printing Good and Evil in Chinese for some time, and but when the Chinese, we actually had it printed in China, but the government keep tabs on them and make them ship everything out. It couldn't be sold internally, and we were slipping books in through different missionaries and stuff to try to get to the Chinese. But here's a printer now who has confidence that he can distribute it inside of China. So, I mean, he's paying us so he can do our work of making the gospel available to the Chinese. I had a dream the other night that I was in China. May not live that long.
We've lived long enough. If it's all you have to do is just have a vision. Vision bigger than just homeschooling. A vision to take those homeschool kids and say, "Let's go pass out tracts. Let's go to the abortion clinic and stand and give the girls the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let's go, let's go to a rescue mission. Let's have a child evangelism class in our home. Well, if you live in the country, let's go ask somebody else if we could have one in their yard and start and have your children start teaching, and then start praying that God would." For our country, pray for a nation, pray for the gospel to go out. God's just looking for people that have his heart, and his heart is to win the lost.